Hi everybody, meet Lauren, a fellow friend from the Sama Sama Cooperative and an early childhood arts educator by day, an illustrator slash mark maker slash artist in life. Lauren, who has deep roots in the Bay Area and a geographic affinity for San Pablo Avenue in particular, shares her wisdom on how to nurture creativity in both little ones and the little me's inside of us grown-ups. Along the way, she has made intentional time and space to reclaim her Filipino cultural heritage and continues to learn about herself, her own needs, while mothering her own children in the day-to-day moments. By the end of the episode, we think you will get inspired to say yes to the direct and indirect invitations to play from the children in our own lives, and we bet you will feel very soothed by her stories and calming voice. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to the Oakland Asian Mom Podcast.
Welcome to the next episode of Oakland Asian Mom. And tonight we also have a treat. Our friend Lauren is joining us on the podcast. And I met Lauren. She's a Sama Sama mama. She's going to be actually the third one on the podcast, actually. I know, there's our charm right here. And for folks who haven't listened to previous episodes, Sama Sama is a Filipino kind of cultural cooperative, and which my family just joined this past summer. So I met Lauren, and while we were camping, I said, "Hey, do you want to be on the podcast?" And she said, "Oh my gosh, what did you say to me? Because I don't want to."
I think I said, "That's my fantasy."
Yeah, it was like, "That's like your dream come true."
Yeah,
and I go, "Oh my god, I love making dreams come true. It's so rare. I don't think I've ever made someone's dream come true."
Well, and then I have to say, I texted, I'm on a group text thread with like eight other women who we all were preschool teachers together at one point. And they were like, "Oh my God, it's our dream for you to be on a podcast. We love your voice."
Oh my God.
I like, you know, sing and read books to kids. And everyone's always like, "You should do a podcast."
You should. Oh, it's true. I feel very soothed right now.
I love that.
There is a podcast like Dad Reads Books or something like that. My friend told me about it, that, instead of he doesn't want to read the books, so he just has the podcast Dad Read the Books. I won't say what friend. He's been on the podcast, so I won't name him. But that's, you know, great. Who you are if you actually are listening. Anyways, well, welcome to the show. And tonight Sarah's drinking wine. I just want to point that out. Folks don't see it because we only use the audio, but it's kind of cool. I kind of wish I had a glass of wine.
It's a big glass. One of those days.
Yeah. So we start out asking our guests the same question to introduce themselves by answering, you know, and sharing, what are your ethnic and cultural roots? Where did you grow up? What places would you call home? And how would you describe your partner and your kids in terms of their race and identity?
Those are great questions. And I thought about it a little bit. I feel like my ethnic cultural roots are, my dad taught me early on to answer that question, "What's your ethnicity?" I remember being like five.
Mm.
And I was like, "I don't even know what ethnicity is." But he was like, "People are going to ask you that, or they're going to ask you, what are you?"
Mm-hmm.
And you say, "I'm a human."
Aww,
my dad's such a hippie. And then you can say, "I'm also Filipino and Caucasian." And I was like, it like made me memorize those words. I'm a human and I'm a Filipino and Caucasian human.
Wow.
Yeah. But I actually think my foremost identity, like when I've traveled in the world, is being from the Bay Area.
Hmm.
Like being from California and being from the Bay Area are big cultural identifiers for me.
We're in the Bay Area. Is there any specific places that really
the East Bay?
Oh, okay.
I have, so this is jumping a little bit ahead. The other question is like, what places do you call home? But well, this is hopefully an Oakland audience. But I was born in San Francisco, but I grew up in Richmond, just on the border with San Pablo. I mean, yeah, with the city of San Pablo. And I've been like moving my way down San Pablo Avenue my whole life. Like I lived in El Cerrito, and then I lived in Berkeley, and on. It was never like more than a few blocks away from San Pablo Avenue, and now I like live on the cross street of Emeryville and in San Pablo. Where did I grow up? I grew up in the East Bay. But also my parents, so they wanted to be homeowners, bought a house in Richmond, but both worked in downtown San Francisco. And my dad grew up, my Filipino grandparents owned a home in Hunters Point, San Francisco. And so I spent most of my first, you know, most of my early childhood in the city with them in their house. My Ilocano grandparents who, I just hung out with them. They weren't creating programming for me the way that I do for my kids. I was just hanging out and cooking and cleaning and living with them. So I even, you know, I slept, woke up and slept in Richmond, but I spent a lot of years in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And a lot of trips over the Bay Bridge.
Yes. I grew up in the peninsula, but we had family in Vallejo. So we'd always take the two bridges to get to Vallejo. Right. And I tell my kids, they're like, oh, get the fast track, because they know about fast track and all that.
Right.
And I go, oh man, when I was a kid, I would have to fight with my family of like who got to throw the coins into that big bucket. And then they're like, make sure you throw it in there so we don't have to get the 35 cents or the 75 cents, whatever. And I was like, can I do it? Literally rolled down the window. So you remember those days.
I do. And I was just saying, my husband is also from the East Bay. He grew up in Berkeley. And he and I were reminiscing about the toll plaza. Oh, son. Years ago, long, long time ago, people used to be in those little booths. And you would give them money and they'd give you a receipt. And I think I have prelingual memories of hearing my dad. He was so cheery. He was always like, hey, like, how are you? Or how's your day going? And I just realized, like, this is recent, the last time we went over the bridge, that I learned so much about interacting with just those tiny interactions with the public. Like, we'll talk about this later when we talk about early childhood, but like, there's these moments where you don't even know that you're modeling how to be.
Yeah.
And it's only kind of like looking back, I'm like, wow, even that small interaction, like, there's all these opportunities we have to kind of model what it's like to be a person in the world for our kids. And I wasn't like, I'm learning about being nice, but there was something in that, just that little bit. Like I got to see that practice every day we drove over the bridge. Anyway, I really liked your question. What places would you call home? Because for me, they're actually like, I mean, I would say certain areas around the East Bay. But I also feel really at home. That's funny. We were talking about commuting and the bridges. I also feel really at home, like in motion, like on public transit. There's something about being like on a subway or on a bus. Maybe because, again, that's like my grandparents took the bus everywhere in the city.
Yeah.
It's like I just feel really like close to myself and close to the public. And when I'm moving, something about that. I don't know why that came up to me as a place where I feel really at home. It's kind of, I don't know, is what it is. And cities.
I know I jumped ahead of asking places which you call home, but how about You're describing your partner and kids in terms of their race and identity.
Yeah, I'm married to a Jewish white man, high school teacher. And I think he would identify, yeah, he would say I'm Jewish and white. He would say he is not culturally Jewish, ethnically Jewish, mm-hmm. non-practicing. It's important to him to mm-hmm. make that distinction. He was not raised like in the faith much. Some practices, but they were mostly held by his Gentile mom.
Mm-hmm.
And our child is Filipino, Jewish, and white.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he knows that. I think he would describe himself that way too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thanks, Lauren.
Yeah.
So actually, this is the first time Lauren and I are meeting, and I kind of just like, I was late to the Zoom. I have all these tech issues. So it was like, oh no, her dream is becoming like less sparkly.
Oh no.
But so Lauren, I understand that you are an artist and also an early childhood educator, and I'm wondering mm-hmm. if you could describe to us the work you do as an artist.
How would I describe the work I do as an artist? I mean, I would say, first of all, that I am an illustrator.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a mark maker. I've heard people, well, there's a new term I just learned, surface artist, which I think is mm-hmm. really cool. I would like to be that, but I'm not sure I am that. I really enjoy drawing and mark making and letter forms, typography, lettering, hand lettering, everything in that realm. And the work I do as an artist, I think, is mostly personal and less commercial. I have sold art and made custom work for folks, but I actually see it more as like an archiving for myself.
Mm.
I do a lot of journaling and drawing from life.
And has that been something that's been part of your life from an early age, or something you discovered as an adult?
No, that's always been with me. But it's funny. It's so interesting. That's the first question. And I think that's like the first, that's how most people would identify me, is as an mm-hmm. artist, but it isn't until recently. Like my creative expression has been with me my whole life, but I've had some resistance or like trouble claiming the title mm-hmm. as an artist, as I think a lot of artists do, because there's a narrative that it's a limited, you know, there's limited spots mm-hmm. for real artists. And that's a big lie, but it's an easy lie to fall for.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of, it was actually when I became an art teacher and really started leaning into arts education that I realized, oh, a lot of this practice is actually for me. A lot of what I'm doing for children is trying to show up for them in a way. I'm trying to show up for me, little me,
mm-hmm.
and give myself permission and nurture my own voice as I'm nurturing theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And what's cool, I'm jumping around, but as I connect with other art educators, I see a lot of us trying to balance which part of this is for me and which part of this is for them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the answer is like, they're the same, you know, they're kind of the same. There isn't a big divide. Like I rise, we rise, we all rise. Like there's no end to creativity, and helping young people find their creative voice actually feeds my energy to have my own creative mm-hmm. voice and creative outlet. But so on a day-to-day basis, the work I do as an artist is I think has a lot to do with seeing things in a particular way as an illustrator. I feel like it's my job to see things in the world, to observe
mm-hmm.
and draw them for whatever they, you know, to get them down on paper, and then that lets other people see through me, like see the world through me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's a, I know you both, we mentioned Courtney Martin, the writer. Mm-hmm. I actually discovered her through Wendy McNaughton, mm-hmm. another illustrator and graphic, incredible graphic artist and educator. And she describes looking as loving. Mm-hmm. Drawing is looking is loving. And I think about that a lot. I feel like it is a way for me to kind of like love on humanity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
May I ask, is your expression, your activity, do you see it in your family history or generations? I'm just curious of like,
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yes. That's such, I'm so glad you asked, because I've also been, I'd say the last, like, you know, 5 years have been like a deep dive into trying to repair the break in my connection to the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
When my grandparents immigrated in the 40s, they were like, nope, never going back. We're not going back. We're not looking back. We're not talking about it. And so my dad and his brothers were raised here very, very like tailored toward the American dream, the American experience. And I decided I really wanted to know more and pass on like an intact, as a repaired bond to that piece of our culture to my son.
Yeah.
And so I've done some of that work. Talking to like healing through storytelling with my dad, asking him a lot about his life. And he's told me stuff that I don't really remember from
mm-hmm.
ever hearing before. We're all kind of like, the family's just sharing a lot more than I think they did when I was young. Oh, this is a long way to say, very recently, I found out that this like cousin of mine was a really famous artist in the Philippines. Yeah. I had no idea. That I just didn't really know anything about him. Ray Albano was like a printmaker and museum curator and social agitator, and that is and was a I think a cousin of my dad's.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And there's a print. We have a print of his that's been framed and in my house. I mean, it was in my house growing up and I didn't know what it was or who made it or anything about it. And then I'm not even sure how it came up, but I was reading about him on like Instagram because there was a retrospective in the Philippines. And I saw a print that looked like the one that was in our house. And I was like, wait, is that the same guy? Is that my uncle?
Oh my gosh.
But there was something about like suddenly there was this very direct lineage of
mm-hmm.
Artistry as not a career, but like as a vocation, as a calling.
Yeah. Yeah.
That it just suddenly, I think I'm making quotations with my fingers, that like capital A arts and culture came from my mom, who had like a Juilliard educated mother and like symphony parents. And I didn't see it in the same way on my dad's side, because mm-hmm. they were working class people, like military. Mm-hmm. My grandma never worked outside of the home. And so I didn't see art with the capital A, you know,
yeah.
coming from that side. And then to find out about it, like I'm like getting chills, like in my 30s, I was like, I don't know. It just felt really, just filled me up. Like, mm-hmm. oh, it's in all of my blood mm-hmm. from both sides, yeah. you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. It was amazing. And then reading about him is like, just his life was really short. He died when he was 38, mm-hmm. I think. But he just did so much so fast, and it was really, I think when I get like, wow, it's too late, like we sometimes do, or I'm like, oh, I don't, what am I even doing? I'm like, hey, he had even less time than you. Come on, stop whining about it. Get up. Yeah. Seize your time. You never know. You know, it's inspiring for me.
Well, I'm so glad I asked.
Yeah. Me too.
So Lauren, will you kind of walk us through your journey into becoming an early childhood educator and how you kind of like incorporate art into that?
Absolutely. Yes. Well, I kind of did a lot of childcare through my first jobs were like summer camp counselor, babysitter. When I did ballet my whole life and I was teaching the baby ballet classes. I like kind of gravitated toward the younger. I loved like 4 and 5 year olds. And went to college for English and came to the end of my time in undergrad. And my mom and dad had, they actually divorced while I was away at school. And I just didn't want to go home. I was a little heartbroken about it. Didn't really want to face it. I'd been away at 4 year college. And one of my dance teachers at the time was like, you know, you would be a great au pair. You should go abroad and be an au pair. Oh, because I think we were in a rehearsal and I was like, how can I travel but not pay anything? And she was like, actually,
there's a way.
Well, I had two choices. I was like, I could be a flight attendant or an au pair. What is that? I had to look it up. But I ended up going matching and moving right after graduation to Italy. And I was an au pair for a year for a family with two young boys. And that's a whole other thing. But that's by the time, it, you know, by the time my resume was just childcare, you know, I came home from Italy. I was working in a restaurant. And decided to do something that wasn't restaurant work because it's so hard on the body. And I started working at Gymboree playing music.
Because
I was getting, you know, my feet were hurting at the end of the day. And I was looking at Craigslist ads. And I saw that singing was there, like you had to sing your audition. I mean, your interview.
Uh-huh.
It was like a big part of the job interview. I was teaching play and music classes, nailed that audition interview, by the way.
There you go.
They were like, do you want to run a center? And I was like, no.
What? They're like, here are the keys.
Yeah. And I was like, I do not want to own a franchise. Thank you very much. But it's teaching parent child classes. Gymboree play and music predates the clothing situation.
Yeah.
And it started as like an early childhood, like a really theory-based program in like a church basement that this mom started for other moms so they could bond with their children over music. Which I was like, cool. This is fantastic. It's so fun. And then I realized I'm kind of like a little over these parents. Can I just work with kids? So somebody was like, maybe you should get your units. This is very roundabout, but I got my units at Merritt College in the meantime, met my husband and got married.
Mm-hmm.
Landed at a Reggio Emilia inspired school in Berkeley. Because I was committed to a life without a commute. So I only looked for schools that were within 5 miles of our house.
Yeah.
And coming full circle, the Reggio Emilia approach is an Italian-inspired philosophy that really centers children. How do I describe it? Just holds up an image of children as protagonists of their own learning. Babies are born with their full intelligence. It's up to us to listen to them and lift up their voices. And that ended up being just the forever home for me. Like, I love that approach to education. The school had been around for a long time. I started working right away, and I'm still there now. That was 10 years ago.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But one of the cool things about the Reggio approach is that they, in that, it's named after a small city in Italy. It's actually not a very well-known method or philosophy in Italy. Most of, like, if I tell Italians about it, they're like, what?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of stuff? It was pretty, the story is that it was damaged really badly in the bombings during World War II. And the city all rallied around building the school. It was the first school, the first building they built after the city was bombed.
Oh.
And they, like, made a commitment as a city to never let war happen again. And they were going to do that by raising children who really believe in, like, justice and freedom and democracy. And so a lot of those tenets, I think, inspire educators out here,
mm-hmm.
and around the world. And they really hold up art and what they call in Italian, like, the poetics or poetic thinking, which doesn't really have a direct translation, but is about artistry and creativity and expression, and the way that children live in this, you know, because your moms, like, kids will pick some, they'll pick up a piece of trash and be like, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And then you're looking at it, you're like, oh, you know what? You're right. Yeah, it is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. If I can let myself see what you're seeing, it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
That I was saying earlier. So, yeah, in that method, I met a lot of people, a lot of educators who were nurturing sensitivity and creativity in young people in a way that I think had always been with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found my people.
Oh, yeah. That's great. So yeah. Kind of like pivoting to your family life, like, what are ways in which you try to, like, incorporate art and culture into, like, your daily rhythms? And especially like hearing, as you talked about, reconnecting with your Filipino heritage, like, how has that sort of played out in some of the daily rhythms in your family life?
It's a little hard for me to think about my, like, the things that I think about as being Filipino, because they are experiences I had or practices I had with my Filipino grandparents. Were what comes to mind first is, like, the totally, is actually not a necessarily an inherently Filipino thing, but maybe a poverty thing about, like, using things over and over and repurpose. Mm-hmm. You know, like, mm-hmm. It's actually, yeah. That's like, comes from the deep resourcefulness of, like, having limited resource.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's something about that that fits into the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Eco-friendly culture too. And the, like, hippie sensibility that both my parents had when they met and in mm-hmm. our house. So, like, that's the thing that comes up first is something about the way we creatively reuse all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
I actually do think that is, like,
yeah, a cultural, like, practice. It's like Joe Coy says, oh, you know, when you have the Cool Whip tub as your lunchbox, or the country crock, like,
yeah.
I pretty much have, like, my mom, I don't know why, still buys cream cheese from Costco, right? It's huge. So she has, like, five of them for, like, you know, the past 10 years, and every time she puts the rice porridge in there, okay, just bring it back to me so I can reuse it.
And, like, you can't even read anything anymore because it's, like, been washed.
So many times.
But it's so funny because it wasn't really, I also didn't really, maybe I was telling you when we were camping, but, like, I didn't connect with other Filipinos until I was mm-hmm. an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, somebody mentioned that blue cookie tin, like, your sewing kit.
Oh,
your
yeah.
Your grandma has a sewing kit and it's in the blue cookie tin. And I was like, wait. What, your family has that? What do you mean everybody has that? It was so
yeah.
This stuff is so, yeah, How do
it's
we
like, you won't find cookies in that cookie tin. You'll just find thread.
Just thread and thimbles wire and who God knows what. But integrating it into our family life, I think that there's something making stuff. My husband doesn't do a ton of making with his hands, but he has an engineer mind. He was, he's a math teacher and came at it through engineering. And so he loves to think about how things work. And my dad was always really interested in how things work. And I mean, I think my mom too. And so I think that it's not just, my son loves to collect things and say they're for a project. I'm sure you can relate. Mm-hmm. So much treasures.
Yeah.
So many treasures in our house. But it's like functional art. He's really trying to make things that are interesting and useful to him. You know, little tunnels for his
mm-hmm.
animals and his figures and cities and little machines. He loves making like traps for us with rubber bands and string and stuff. And there's something about that, like there's always time for making some, like, I don't know. I think about that as integrating some kind of makership into his day. He just I'm never like, leave that alone. You have to go. There's just always a little bit of time for mm-hmm. that. I don't know if that answers your question. But,
oh, that's great. Yeah. Thank you. How old is your son?
He's 7.
Oh, yeah. So yikes. Sweet.
Yeah.
So old.
It's like 7 still feels young to me. My eldest
is young.
8. She's turning 9 this fall. And
that's old.
9. Yeah. 9 feels like really big. It's so close to 10. But 7 still feels like,
He's just bigger than he's ever been. Which will always be true.
Yeah.
But yeah. And his smells have changed.
Oh. You know,
he's not a baby.
No. Yeah.
It's wild. Yeah. He just had his first, this is an aside, had his first swim lesson today and he was describing it to me. And it's actually in the same pool that my swim lessons were in.
Oh.
And I was like, wait. And then as he was describing it, I suddenly like remembered the sun and like where everything was. And I was like, wait a minute. That's so wild. I totally forgot that I even had swim lessons.
Now that he's out of like the preschool years, what are your reflections about that developmental period of time that he
had? This is the question that I was like, whoa. Wait, is he out of? Oh my God, he is.
And the only reason we ask because we know that you spend your, you know, a lot of your time the past 10 years in preschool, right?
Staring at very young people. Now that he's out of them, my reflections about that developmental period, I mean, the first thing that I felt like I needed to say was that I made so many good choices. I'm so proud of myself.
Yay.
And it's been a journey for me to figure out how to actually rest in being pleased with myself. This is my own like healing journey. I'm pretty hard on myself, but I was like, I look at him at 7 and I can tell I'm seeing the fruits of my labor.
Oh, sweet.
Of the early childhood years where I'm like the way that he thinks about himself. It's not perfect. It's not perfect, but he values his work. Like I said, you know, there's always like, you want 5 more minutes to like build that trap? Okay. Or all those minutes added up to a child who really values the work that he's doing because we hold his work in esteem. And that work started when he was a baby. I say this as an educator and I say this to myself as a parent too, that like we call it work, but it's just life. Like what babies are doing is learning all the time in all the different ways they can. And I feel like we let his learning happen naturally and just watched for how he was learning and listened to mm-hmm. how and what he was learning versus like telling him what to learn. Yeah. And I see someone who is so motivated to know things,
mm-hmm.
motivated from inside. And that is like, I was like, I'm good. We did it. We did. I think I was a little worried that leaving early childhood and entering elementary school, which our education system is flawed. We know that. And I thought that it was gonna, he might lose some of that intrinsic motivation,
mm-hmm.
but he hasn't yet. So that's good.
Yeah.
I want to say one more thing too, is mm-hmm. that I believe this before, but even more now that I've done it and been through the early childhood years, that every parent is doing their best.
Mm-hmm.
I really believe so hard that every parent is doing their best at any given moment, and that you learning, like, the name of the game is co-regulation. Whatever you need to do, happy mommy, happy baby. Oh, mm-hmm. I said that so much through my pregnancy and like the first 3 years / I still say it to myself.
Yeah.
I'm like, what do I need?
Mm-hmm.
That actually comes first before mm-hmm. what he needs. And I see that's part of why he's so regulated and motivated and all those things, is because I really worked hard. I'm still working every day to mm-hmm. try to embody them and learn them with him. So I'm not trying to, you know, make him do something that I'm not doing.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It, I'm kind of like eating up all your words because I'm like, yes, it does take so much work.
It's so hard.
Coordination, emotional work, even like time. Okay.
Yeah.
What can I do to fill that fills my soul, that like, and then mm-hmm. when I'm parenting, I could feel, you know, my happy self to be with them.
Yeah.
And like earlier on in our conversation, you talked a little bit about like the little modeling that we do and then see its impact. This week, I just have my eldest, the youngest is in at grandma's house. He has his middle school orientation, so that's why he's just here. And today he was at my work and he opened the door for somebody, like a lady who was coming in. And I go, oh, it felt awkward because it was like, oh, is he opening the door for her? And like, you know, but that's fine. The lady goes, why, thank you. You know, and then his best friend's mom picked him up from orientation and they went out to tacos. And the mom, of course, paid. She was so kind. She paid for her tacos. And I told him, just insist that you pay. Just insist. And he goes, she paid for me, mommy. But I gave a $10 tip to the taco truck. And I was like, wow, that's great. So I was like, okay, he's getting a little bit of what it means to be respectful and generous. Those little things that we don't necessarily teach, but yet they learn from our little modelings over time. Right.
Yeah.
So part of it is like, oh my gosh, they're watching us at all times. Am I messing up? And then at the same time, it's like, how do I just be myself too and relax into it? So it is that, it's that tension, right?
I have to say, we're somewhere now that I dreaded the video games.
Oh, yes.
I also am pretty pleased that it took this long, but we just didn't. I was like, no screens until we need them. Like, I just not until we need them. And we haven't, for whatever reason, he just hasn't been into it. But he started playing this just really horrible free game. It's like one of those running games. A character's just running. They're collecting
on a laptop or something?
It's on a phone, an old phone we have.
Yeah.
It's like running on a subway track, collecting coins. I don't know. It's like the worst. But we do a thing where we sit together and we take turns. He plays a round, I play a round. And I was getting really frustrated because it was really hard. I don't play games on my phone.
No,
so
me neither.
Eye coordination is really bad. And I, before my turns, I would go, okay, Lauren, you can do this. You're learning. It's new. It's okay. You, like, it's just a game. I was like saying all that stuff out loud. And I heard him saying it to himself later. Aww. And it just made me, I was like, yeah, I don't have to show him this brave face, knows everything and is good at everything. And there's something about that that just made me, I don't know, reminded me and reinforced for me this thing we say in early childhood all the time, that your parents are your first teacher.
Yeah.
Parents are their first teachers, and they're going to do what you do, not what you say.
Yeah.
And yeah. That's
kind of what like,
talking about.
I'm feeling a little horrified.
Oh, I've also heard him like knock things down and yell, damn it. And I'm like, oh, that's me. Yeah. I'm like, I mean, you got the context.
I want to ask for the why you're so horrified, Sarah, but that's another episode.
Well, briefly, probably because, like you mentioned, Lauren, I'm like, my default is to be hard on myself. So it's like, kind of like, I think I automatically think about like the imperfect moments and like, hopefully, like, I think I am, you know, I think Cheryl and I may have talked about this before, but I didn't grow up with parents that ever apologized for like poor behavior or losing their temper or like, you know, being out of line. And I think that's a practice that I take pretty seriously with my kids. So, you know, I mean, I guess it's like every generation we just try to do better, right?
Yeah.
I really believe that.
Yeah.
I tell myself, he's absolutely going to be in therapy, but is it going to be for something different?
Yeah.
I need it to be for different things, not the same stuff.
Yeah. I think when I first went to a therapist and I described like my childhood and all that, she said something to me like, wow, you really had a pretty great childhood. And I was like, I don't know if I wanted to be like irritated by that or like proud. Like, I guess so. So what are you saying? but so I hope that when our kids seek out some kind of mental health or just, you know, process with their friends, like they can reflect of like, yeah, actually, it was pretty darn good. And my parents did the best that they could.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, I was wondering, you know, you sort of shared a little bit, but do you have any like simple tips or words of wisdom that you have for parents who want to nurture both their own creativity and their child's creativity?
Yeah, I mean, I think, okay, I'm, like I was saying this a little before we started recording. I'm a dancer. My background is in dance. And I've done ballet, modern, I mean, since I was five. I currently study hula in Berkeley. And I desperately wanted Otis to dance. And I was like, if I just have him around me, he'll dance too. It'll just be natural. I'll just bring him into the studio. And no, not a dancer.
No.
Not at all.
No.
But I realized as I see him coming into his expression, his own unique expression, it's not important for him. I think it's actually been incredibly valuable that he sees me dance. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have to also dance, but he sees me do something that's not for money, that's not for his dad, that's not for, you know, it's something that's really for me. And he, you know, he's seen me on stage. He's like, hung out in the studio. What are my tips? And I practice at home. Mm-hmm. His dad also is a musician sometimes, you know, on the weekends, but practices a lot at night.
Yeah.
And I think for him to see us, you know, pursuing something not to be, we're not like a career artists, but for him to see us working at it and trying to get better because we want to, I think has nurtured some of that motivation we were talking about earlier. Or he,
yeah.
But tips for nurturing them together, really just keeping, I don't know, keeping things playful, like playing together is really creative too. I do think that this is my teacher coming out, and there's something that can be really frustrating for kids when you're being creative together and you're better than they are.
Yeah,
let's draw together, and you're like, oh, I'm enjoying this, oh, I haven't drawn for months, oh, this is so satisfying to me. And then suddenly they're like, I don't know how to draw a person at all. It's so frustrating. So I think if you can differentiate between times when you're nurturing your creativity, and then you're like adding your attention to them being creative, that can be like, you know, they get to draw and you are just watching, or you're drawing with your non-dominant hand, or you're like, I'll make a border and you work on the middle, like kind of finding a place where you can be there, but like centralize their experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that make sense? I think the young child can be really sensitive to, it's risk-taking.
Yeah.
Sometimes creativity is risky, and there's an opening for that inferiority to come in when you're kind of using that shared time for yourself. That's not always true. That's not always going to happen. Yeah. But I have seen that happen sometimes where it'll eat away at, like, it's not joyful for them to be creating with you if you're always better.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's very, very interesting.
Yeah. And it's not, and I think there's also like, I don't blame that parent, because there's like a huge deficit of play in our lives. So as adults, but it is, you know, it's also like, it's not very fun to play catch with someone who doesn't play catch well, but you know, deciding to meet them where they are and be where they are and try to see, you know, see the fun where they are seeing it. Put your experience aside. Even a few minutes of doing that has immense like ripple effect to when you're meeting them in that creative arena. And just being with them where they are, that really goes a long way. I think it shows a really deep respect for like where they are and where their learning is happening, that children can feel like with their whole bodies. And I think it shows them how to honor their own work and their own creative work.
Yeah, I think it takes like a level of sort of humility, you know, and to like break down this whole parent is in charge of the child kind of deal. Because it takes me back when I did some like parent-child therapy work, I remember, with parents who always felt like they were need to be in control and had to always direct people's emotions and play. Like, we would do art things where I'd be like, okay, the child, so-and-so, is going to just keep on drawing on a piece of paper, and your job is to just follow that line with your, your so pencil. Funny. And sometimes it was really hard for the parent to just follow the pencil or the line that the kid was drawing. You know, so we have a big old paper, and just all your job is following that pencil, or even doing mirror, like, okay, we're going to do that, you know, just do a mirror game.
Yeah.
And a part of me was like, oh, it's really challenging for the parent. And then sometimes I'm wondering, oh my gosh, they may think I'm like kind of a crazy lady making them do all these things. But I feel like, okay, thank you for saying all these, because I mean, it does make a difference, you know, when parents take the time to mirror their children and make space for them. Because oftentimes, I would say 23 hours of the day, you know, they're supposed to be in charge, or they're the ones directing life. Right.
But I don't, none of this is easy. This like society, now that my child's out of the preschool years, my reflections about that developmental period of time are that this is not normal for us to parent and work. It is work.
Yeah.
It is a full day's work and more to parent, and the conditions, I have seen it change in 10 years. I mean, just the pressure, and this is context specific to the Bay Area.
Yeah.
I think also the bracket of preschool. I'm in a private preschool, so I'm seeing two parent families with at least one parent in tech. That's how they afford childcare in mm-hmm. the Bay Area. Like mm-hmm. that's just, I'm not seeing working class parents. And I imagine it's even worse for that demographic, but the pressure on parents is impossible. The financial setup for even affording childcare is it's the loop of, this is a whole soapbox, but what I first thought of when I saw that question was that parents are superheroes
mm-hmm.
and that children are lucky to get whatever they get from us. Like, seriously, it's really, the kids are gonna be okay. Mm-hmm. Parents are not okay. And I think, yeah, I don't know why I got into that, but I just these tips or like my perspective does not come without the caveat that I understand and that parenting is really hard right now.
Yeah.
And yeah, and that I think that parents, I just wish that they could find a little rest and play of their own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Respite is good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The last question we had on official before we have our closing segment what is your latest passion project idea? And I don't know if that would, if you have one that you could just share really quick. Just choose one.
There's so
just
many
choose
things
one.
That I enjoy, that I'm enjoying. Well, over the pandemic, I joined a Filipino arts collective called Apecto, thinking, let me meet other artists and share some resources. I don't know. I thought we would chat a little, but actually we have a show in Manila.
Oh my gosh.
In January. That's the project I'm working on right now. I'm working on kind of a series of images that are all a series of images that are accompanied by and sort of centered on a big 3D map of the Philippines that I'm cutting from paper. That somehow I'm going to get transport to Manila, and I'm going to go to the Philippines for the first time.
Oh, wow.
In two generations. So that's,
we're going to be there. I'm going to be there, I'm going to be there December, but only a couple of days in January. So we will probably
end of January.
Oh,
I know. Wait.
But if you need me to, I don't know. I don't know where we're going to be.
Yeah, I should just feed pieces to like.
Part A is going with Cheryl.
Here, take this. But that's what I'm working on. It's really slow because I work on it like a few minutes a month, literally. It's really weird.
Wow. Oh my gosh. We'll have to have you back on.
Yeah.
You'll have to talk to me in
February next year.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's a lot. And but I think I'm excited about it. I think I'm gonna draw all the houses that my grandma lived in.
Wow.
I recently found out that my sister-in-law is like a biologist and geneticist, or she's not she doesn't work in genetics, but knows a lot of stuff. I don't know anything about genetics. But we were talking about something about women, and she's like, there's actually some genetic information that only passes from female to female. And I realized we've held up my Filipino grandmother as a rock of our family, and she only gave birth to sons. And I have been integrating, that was like a month ago, there was something in me that was she's so strong in story in our family, and we all have memories of her, but there was something about realizing that there's some information that ended when she died That was so sad to me. And then I realized it's true for me too. I have one child and he's a male. And so there's like some information that's going to get lost with my death.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, I decided to kind of make her and her life the center of that project.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's weird.
So moving. That's very moving. Yeah.
Yeah. So personal and deep, you know,
mm-hmm.
deeply personal. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's great.
Thanks for asking.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to move on to our closing segment. Lauren has chosen to answer, what is your favorite Asian mom saying? And then we'll go on to our other questions after that.
Okay. So I don't have an Asian mom. This is my Asian grandma.
Mm-hmm.
This is classic Catholic passive aggression.
That's a lot of things.
Any question, she would raise her eyebrows and go, up to you. Oh, which one of these do you think I should wear? Up to you. Grandma, what do you think? What do you think about? Up to you. And I'm like, I mean, your words are empowering, but everything in your expression is like blaming me. But we say it to each other all the time. We say it to each other all the time in my family.
Maybe.
kind of love it because it's funny.
It totally is, because I think it's a it's been passed on to generations and generations. Yeah. Because I hear that too. And mine starts with, it's up to you.
Yeah.
It has a little.
It's like, let me think. No.
Yeah.
She's like, I have an opinion. I'm just not going to say it. And pretend.
Same with my eyes and my eyebrows.
Exactly.
Well, it's so funny.
Is the Catholic part being, is like, is it the guilty part, or is it the, what is the Catholic? It's the Filipino Catholic.
Right? I don't know. This like, well, I feel, is that Catholic? The like, this sort of like, well, you're going to go where you're going anyway.
Oh, yeah.
It's, you
like,
know, the
Bahalana, like, but just like, you know, leave it up to God, you know?
Yeah, yes. It's out of my hands. It's also out of yours, actually.
I just, like the Jesus hands, or the God, the God's hands, out of God's hands.
Oh, that's so funny. And then
I'm going to use it now. Start
saying it.
Up to you,
but then it's sort of like, you know what to do.
Yeah,
you know what's right.
You know.
And then, Lauren, what was a really nourishing practice for you this year, and also just something ordinary that was? Let's see. Sorry, I'm messing up this question.
It's a nourishing practice, but also something that was ordinary thing that you're grateful for.
We did a hybrid. I chose a hybrid combo. I've had an alarm clock since I was 5, and I would just wake up in like panic and be like, whoa, what are we doing? And I've like been healing my morning routine from I've tried a lot of things, like waking up super early, waking up naturally, but I figured out the like perfect morning routine for me is to set my alarm for an hour before I actually want to get up.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just chill in bed. I don't read. My eyes aren't even open, but I'm awake. I'm awake. I'm totally awake. Sometimes I even get up and go to the bathroom and then come lay back down. But I've been like savoring the hour before I have to get up. I also don't have a young child anymore, so mm-hmm. I can do that.
Yeah.
But that has been a really nourishing, ordinary thing with the window open, let me say.
The breeze. You like the breeze, the air.
Yeah. Yep. And trying to actually really notice like the light and the sounds and the air like changing. Just, I've been enjoying that early hour so, so much,
mm-hmm.
especially this summer.
Mm-hmm. Sounds sort of meditative in some way.
Yeah.
It is. Mm-hmm. It totally is. Do I fall asleep sometimes? Yes. But sometimes I don't. and then I just savor it.
So do you have like two alarms, one an hour early and then one that's your normal, like I gotta get out of
no the other one is my partner.
Okay.
He has like a clockwork routine.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah,
but yeah I'll set it again if mm-hmm. I know, you know, if we're mm-hmm. off. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
sometimes that happens to me like unintentionally, where I'll wake up an hour or so before I really need to wake up, and then it's like I feel relieved because it's like, okay, I don't have to get up yet, and then I could just rest, I could mm-hmm. go all back asleep. So I know, yeah, it's not a regular practice of mine, but when it happens, it is, there's something really nourishing about it.
That's so magical.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
my mistake earlier was like trying to do things in that first hour. Oh, I need to wake up early and exercise. I need to wake up early and write in a journal. And I was like, no, I think I need to wake up early and like just be yeah. alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For a little bit before other things happen to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of the quiet, the solitude in some ways that you need. Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah. This is so fun.
Yeah, we could go all night, but I know we gotta.
No, I can't.
Yeah, she was up late.
I was up till 2:30.
That's right.
Such a bad idea.
But thanks for making the time, Lauren. It's just super fun to get to know you a little bit more and hear all these different parts of your journey and your story. This is the reason why I feel like the heart of our podcast is to be able to do this.
Thanks for making my dreams come true and the dreams of lots of my friends. Apparently, who wanted to hear my voice on a podcast.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll send it to them and hopefully they can be one of our listeners. That'd be awesome.
I love it. Yay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care and don't forget to call your mom.